Welcome back to Round Game Strong. My name is Mitali, or Mitali, and I am your host. I had to practice this like 7 times, no joke, because I have been so out of practice. I know it's been a hot minute. This will be worth it, trust me. I'm so excited to bring you a brand new guest episode today with a very exciting guest who is an author, and her name is Sarah Nisha Adams. She's just released her debut novel, The Reading List, which is now available to purchase anywhere that you buy your books. And I mean, let me just say that being a podcast host does come with its perks, because sometimes you get sent books before they are released, and I got the opportunity to read it and really, really enjoyed it, and then actually got to pick Sarah's brain afterwards. I mean, how many times do you read a book and then are actually able to have a conversation with the author about them? So yeah, felt like quite a G. But the reason why I'm so excited for this, because I am also a book lover, and I've grown up with books being such a big part of my life, and I could happily drown in books and never talk to another person again. I feel like that's a bit of an exaggeration, but yeah, so if you are a book lover, you will love this episode. I also feel like if you're interested in kind of writing your own book and you're not sure about how to go about it, what the publishing process is like, etc., then I'll have you know that Sarah actually works full-time in publishing. And she wrote this book on the side, but she's actually shared a lot of nuggets of wisdom from her own experience of publishing The Reading List. And she just also shares with us a lot of insights into what the process was like writing every single day, especially in a pandemic, and, you know, how she overcame her little niggling voice in her head, the self-doubt, the fear of what people are going to think, and all of those things that we talk about on Brown Game Strong. I honestly, considering that this was the first time I had spoken to Sarah, it just didn't feel like it, because we were just two bookworms just connecting over our love for books, and we spoke at length about this amazing book that, you know, I've so greatly enjoyed reading. And just to give you kind of a bit of background about The Reading List. So what's so special about it is actually so much of it is inspired from Sarah's own life. As someone who is half English and half Gujarati and has spent her life split between Hertfordshire and Wembley, and one of the protagonists, Mukesh, is actually inspired by her own granddad. Isn't that so cute? He's this widower who is trying to connect with his late wife, who used to love reading. And he joins the local library and meets this young woman called Alicia, who is going through her own struggles at home with caring for her mum. And so there are topics around mental health and loneliness, depression, and also just connection, friendship, reading. And it's just, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful story. And I would definitely encourage you to pick up your copy and read it. But first, have a listen to this episode, because I feel like you will really, really enjoy hearing the incredible Sarah speak. And she's so wise and soft-spoken and just lovely. And yeah, I just had the best time. So yeah, anyway, I'm going to stop gushing and get straight into the episode. But I hope you enjoy it. I hope you're keeping well. And I'm sending you all my love. I'll see you on the other side. Hello, Sarah. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly.
Yes, absolutely. Lovely to meet you, Mitali.
Oh, welcome to Round Game Strong. It's such a pleasure to have you on. I'm not going to lie. Like I said to you earlier, I feel a little bit starstruck just because I have been sitting with your book for the last couple of days, and I feel like I've kind of gotten a peek into your brain. And so it just feels surreal to me to be able to actually pick your brain even further. So it's just amazing to have you on. How are you doing today?
I'm good, thank you. That's so nice to hear, because I think obviously when you're writing a book and it's very much for a long time just you and the book, so it's been so lovely to kind of hear people reading it, and yeah, so lovely to hear that you've been reading it and enjoying it. Yeah, it's definitely a little peek into my brain, I think, that book.
It's a beautiful book, and I have so many questions, so I hope we have enough time to cover everything, because there's just so much to unpack with this book. But I just want to, I guess, start off by asking you if you could tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, where you grew up, and all of that good stuff.
So I am Sarah Nisha Adams, and I grew up in Hertfordshire, just outside of London. My mum is Indian Gujarati and my dad is English. So I kind of grew up in like a very white middle class area. And I remember for a long time, I was like the only brown person I knew. And my mum was the only brown person I lived with, and that I think that has kind of shaped the book in lots of ways. My mum's family are from Wembley, which is where the book is set, and my mum grew up in Wembley too, so I remember like trips to Wembley. I would spend a lot of time there when I was younger, and I just remember feeling like I didn't stand out for once, and I really loved that. So I think for me, my heart was definitely in Wembley and in Hartford. I loved Hartford in lots of ways. But yeah, so that was me, and I went to school and was very nerdy. I loved reading books. I would always just hide behind books all the time. I remember going to libraries when I was really young and doing the summer reading challenge and feeling just like libraries were the place where you could let your imagination run free. And I remember one time my dad took me to the library and I just read this amazing book, and I spoke to the librarian about it for about an hour, and she listened so patiently. But yeah, so the book is very much about libraries being safe spaces. And I think for me growing up, libraries were very much a safe space and a creative space for me. So it feels like the book is very much my heart. And yeah, I kind of studied English at university. My mum really wanted me to do law and I managed to like not do that. I mean, I really wanted to at one point, but then I was like, oh, it's not really me. I think I want to do something I really love. And I loved English. I was lucky enough to get into Cambridge and studied there. Kind of had so much crippling self-doubt when I was studying, because I sort of think studying English in the depth that I did almost made me forget my love of reading. I kind of started thinking of reading as a bit of a chore, and I was worried about it. So like, I remember the day of my final exam, I just said I could either not pick up a book to read for fun, or I will pick up a book to read for fun and get straight into it and try to remember what it felt like to read a book without having to like analyze it and study it. So yeah, that book was, I think, Angela Carter's The Magic Toy Shop. And I just remember it was so freeing to read a book for fun after studying it for so long and feeling like I wasn't taking the right things from books. And I think I just wanted to read a book where I felt like whatever I took from it, there wasn't a right or wrong. And yeah, so that's, I think, another inspiration behind the book. I am in publishing now. So after that, I knew that I wanted to write, really, but I didn't know how to make that work as a career. And I definitely had my mum still saying, are you sure you don't want to try law now? And then I managed to get into publishing. I was really lucky, and kind of tried really hard to do anything I could, and like get internships with people and do work experience and just find out anything about the industry that might help me get in and also see what it was like for writers. And as soon as I started working in publishing, I fell in love with the job itself. So I work in editorial, so very much working with writers and kind of working with story and plot. And I think that was, in a way, the best exercise to work out the story, what stories I wanted to write as well. And I just loved every moment of it, but I realised I'd stopped writing as well, because working in editorial, you've got lots of reading to do. Kind of my life was consumed with books, in a good way and in a really fun way, in a way that it wasn't quite so much like that at uni, but in a way that just made me forget that I had my own dreams of being a writer too. I was reading almost round the clock, and then one day I just said to myself, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to have to make time for it. So I started waking up early to write some words down, and eventually those words became this book.
Wow, that's incredible. I relate so much to your childhood of reading books. I was exactly the same. I was a bookworm. I used to sit in my little corner, and I think the ultimate, like the best day for me would be just being engrossed in my Harry Potter book, or I was a huge fan of Roald Dahl, you know, all of those amazing stories. And I resonate with what you said about just being able to just be immersed into, you know, these like different worlds, and it's just not something you get in real life. You know, you can create a complete like new dimension in your head. And I mean, for those of us who read, I think we can all relate to that. So completely agree. And I love that you took this route of, you know, getting your foot in the door and then realizing that you really loved the job itself, as well as having your passion for writing, which you have also pursued. So, you know, that's incredibly inspiring that you woke up before your full-time job to write this book. Did you think that it was going to become a book, or did you write with the intention of just writing and just letting it flow and just seeing where it took you?
I think with this one, I definitely wrote with the intention of it being a book. And I think probably because I came up with the idea when I'd already been working in publishing probably like 3 or 4 years at the time. And so I realized I had that publishing awareness as well, that I think probably found its way into the story in lots of ways. And I know that I've learned loads about structure and plotting after working with books and editing books. So I think that definitely helped hone the story. Before that, I've definitely written things just to see where the writing took me. But quite often I lost my patience with it, and I lost the enthusiasm for it quite quickly. So this one I actually plotted out really in depth before I really started it. And I found that really worked. I have since written my second book and tried that again, and it didn't work. So that one was one where I tried to write more freely. So I think for me, I've realized that it's just a case by case basis. Some books, I definitely think some stories, I think I need to know where it's going to go. I need a blow by blow breakdown of it. But yeah, I have tried things before and I've just kind of got an idea of what I want, but haven't known for sure. And for me, that often doesn't quite work. I think because there are so many other distractions in my life, I know that unless I really commit to something and have a really clear idea, I'm not sure if I'll ever finish it. So this one, I told myself, this is going to be a book, I'm going to get it done, and this is what's going to happen, and things can change on the way. But I just tried to really focus this time because I knew that I'd tried so many times. I started something, put it away, never looked at it again. I didn't want that to happen with this one. It almost felt too personal, the story, to me. And yeah, it just felt like the story I needed to write, I think.
You should be so proud of yourself that you actually made it to the finish line, and it's a physical thing. It exists in the world.
I can't believe it. It must be
really surreal. Yeah, I can imagine. And I've never told anybody this, but in lockdown, I started writing a book, and then it's just been somewhere in my Google Docs.
Google Docs is so great, though. I think having it somewhere in your Google Docs, that was a game changer for me too, knowing that I could write something in Google Docs and it would be anywhere with me. Because I was writing on like the tube on my mobile phone and stuff too, just to make sure I still kept writing it. So yeah, I think that's a really good way to do it.
I have some creative friends who also write in their notes app. Yeah. And there are people who write poetry and just random little thoughts, which end up turning maybe into blog posts. And I've also heard them turn into books. So it's a really great thing that we now live in a time where you don't have to, you know, sit at this, I don't know, I always imagine this like big mahogany desk, and you know, you've got your like really nice pen and all of your like fancy sheets of paper, and you're just writing this book. And yeah, now it's just like you're on the tube and you're just typing away on your phone and, you know, just trying to figure it out. Actually, going back to your background, you said that you grew up in Hertfordshire, which was a very, very British, very white town. And then you also spent a lot of time in Wembley, which was a complete opposite. I find it really interesting that you've had both of those really extreme, drastically different experiences. Do you think that it left you a little bit confused about where you stood when you were growing up? And, you know, how South Asian were you? How British were you? Did you have those thoughts in your head?
So I think when I was growing up, I felt that I didn't feel too different, because of course, living in Hertford, that was sort of exactly what I knew. I felt very similar to lots of my friends in loads of ways, but there were some little incidents every so often that would happen that made me feel a bit different, like I didn't wholly belong. There was a moment when we were talking about kind of world foods at school, and someone said to me, oh, sorry, you should know where curry's from. And I remember my mum having told me that, like, not all curry is actually from India, and actually some of it is British. So I said, actually, curry's from Britain. And everyone laughed at me and said, you of all people should have known where it's from. It's actually Indian. And like, there were little things like that that would happen and they'd all add up. And in my school, there were very few non-white children, basically. And I did feel, as the years went on, a little bit different. And then at the same time in Wembley, I loved being in Wembley because I didn't feel quite so different. But at the same time, I was quite fair skinned and I had a language barrier. Like I never learned Gujarati, so I couldn't speak to my grandparents in their language. So there were all these little barriers that I think kind of made me feel like I was almost between two worlds. And I think that's very much been how I feel a lot of the time. I'm quite lucky in terms of on my dad's side. So my cousin is also mixed race, and it feels like we're quite a mix anyway. So I've always felt like I've lived in quite a multicultural world, except when I was in Hartford and everything was quite different. But yeah, I think lots of the time I didn't feel different, but then there are those little things that pull you out of the moment sometimes and make you think, actually, yeah, I'm not quite like this and I'm not quite like that. So I have always felt like, I think lots of people say best of both worlds, but sometimes it can be the worst of both worlds too. But I do know that having grown up where I've grown up, it's meant that like I have learned to operate in kind of predominantly white spaces in certain ways, and I know how to be in those, and I don't always feel too different because that's been my upbringing. And I understand that with that comes privilege in the fact that I have over many years learned how to operate in those spaces. So yeah, there are pros and cons, but I definitely feel that I sort of sat between two worlds for a long time.
Yeah, I feel you. And I think when you're also that young, you don't think of it as, you know, microaggressions, or you don't think of it as anything really. You just think, oh, that was weird. Yeah. And then you grow older and you're like, oh, that's what that was.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just very, very interesting when you're going through it at that age. And, you know, you think everything's normal because your default is normal, whatever normal even is. I guess it's just normal would be, you know, what everyone else is looks like or does. Then suddenly there's small things that remind you that, oh, no, actually, I'm slightly different. So, yeah, I do feel that. And I also had a lot of that when I was growing up. I love that so many of us have had this very similar experience, but almost like at the same time, but we didn't know we were all going through
it. I know, yeah. Exactly. There are so many people like I've met in later life who've had like a similar upbringing to me, and I kind of connect with them immediately. And I was never quite sure why, but I just think it is that shared experience, and it is quite a unique experience. So it is so lovely to meet people in like later on who have gone through similar things.
Yeah. Yeah. And to bond over it and just to be like, okay, now I understand that. Also, just wanted to know a little bit about your experience with books growing up. So who were your favorite authors? What kind of books did you like to read as a kid?
I read basically everything. So Diana Wynne Jones was one of my favorite authors when I was younger. So she writes quite a lot of like fantasy, but she's written like whole series, and she's written like standalones as well. And they're so imaginative and they just create whole worlds. I think that was actually one of the books I was talking to a librarian about for like a whole hour, because there's so much that goes on in them. I love those. I think they just really expanded my imagination in really great ways. I loved a lot of fantasy when I was younger. I think that was like my go-to. I did read a lot of Harry Potter, and I also love like the Lemony Snicket books.
Oh, they love those. So good. Series of Unfortunate Events.
Yeah, they were so fun. So I think those were my go-tos when I was younger. There's also an author called Jonathan Stroud who kind of also writes fantasy. I love them more than Harry Potter. They were just, they were really fun. And I think there were only three of them in the trilogy, one of the trilogies. And that wasn't enough for me. I would have read like happily 20 of those books. But I loved all things fantasy. Anything that felt really different to the world we lived in, while having themes that resonate with all of us.
Having now read your writing, I can see elements of that in it. I want to know as well, you mentioned about your cultural background and, you know, how you kind of were part of these two worlds. Did you have any challenges that you feel greatly inspire your writing?
Yes. I mean, I think mental health has always been a really big thing in my life and in the lives of people I love. So I think even before I knew the words for it, I was always conscious of that and conscious of things like depression and anxiety that I now know what they are. And I remember even when I was quite young, I saw it around me and in the people I loved and in myself too. And I think I've always, yeah, I think that's always been a big thing for me, and it's always fed into my writing. And this book, definitely mental health is a really big theme, and kind of navigating it and living with people who have mental health issues, and while you're also potentially going through something yourself. So that's always been something that I've thought about. When I was about 19, I lost one of my really close friends to suicide. So that is also something, just this idea of almost some things coming out of the blue. And if you haven't necessarily spoken about mental health, because for a long time when I was growing up, no one really spoke about it. No one really knew what it was. We didn't have the conversations that we had today, that we have today, though there's still a long way to go. So that's all, I think I knew that I wanted to write a book that sort of didn't sensationalize it, but in a way, just, I think so many people we know and love have mental health issues that they're working through, that they're living with, and that is just a part of life in the same way that I think for me, I wanted to write a story where kind of someone's cultural background and like being brown is just like normal life. It's not the story itself, because I've seen so many things where almost it's made the whole plot of the novel, or it's kind of sensationalized in a way, or the whole point is race, or the whole point is mental health. But actually, I wanted to see what it was like for characters to just live in, yeah, live with these things. And it's just a part of who they are rather than being all of who they are.
Yeah. I think you've done a really beautiful job of not sensationalizing a lot of these big topics that are being spoken about a lot more openly, such as mental health. When I picked up your book, I thought it was, you know, a South Asian book. And there obviously are elements of, you know, there are characters that are South Asian. But really, funnily enough, I can't tell the ethnicity of all of the characters. And I don't know if you did this like deliberately, but, you know, all of Alicia's family, I could not tell where they were from culturally, just because there, I think you deliberately make their names slightly ambiguous?
Yeah, that was a conscious choice for me for Alicia's family in particular. I knew that I wanted Mukesh's family to be quite clearly Gujarati Hindus, who kind of came from Kenya as well, because that's my mum's family's background. But for Alicia, I wanted people to be able to read themselves into her if they wanted to. And I remember often finding I didn't want to be prescriptive about her background or her cultural heritage or anything like that. I wanted readers to kind of come to her and any of the characters really as they wanted and kind of read themselves in the characters. Because I remember growing up sometimes reading books where I would really connect with the character, and then even small things, I know it's really silly, but I really wanted to just see a character who looked just like me. And quite often then you'd get descriptions of like really blonde hair, and I was like, oh, that's not me. And it just, I would feel the distance creep in, even though if on the kind of character level we were so similar in lots of ways, I know that that was always a little niggling thing for me. And I think it's probably because growing up I did feel and look a little bit different, so I wanted to find that, yeah, similarities in characters. So yeah, I did make that conscious decision to kind of keep it quite ambiguous so people from all different backgrounds and heritages can read themselves into those characters if they want to.
And that is the beauty of reading as well, isn't it? It's you kind of conjure up a movie in your head of, yeah, based on your own experiences and your own biases, which is why I guess so many people argue that the books are, you know, usually better than the films.
Yeah, I think
if
so.
There are like film depictions done as well of a book, which I totally agree with. And, you know, to your point you made earlier about not being able to read enough because life gets in the way is so true, because I think when you go to university, or especially, I mean, studying English literature for yourself, it must have been just a completely different way of approaching reading, and it might have ruined it for you a little bit, right? If you just wanted to sit down just for fun and read a book without overanalyzing all the themes and everything. So yeah, I totally get that. I had years where I didn't read, just because it was a lot. So I'd always watch the film versions and then feel really sad because I was like, yeah, I missed out on reading the book first and now I know what's going to happen.
Yeah, it's so true. And yeah, I think reading a book sometimes you're just never not in the mood for it. I find that as well. Like, I really sometimes have to try to read a book because it is so much about you having to kind of commit yourself to the page too. But yeah, I totally get what you mean about sometimes the film versions not being quite as good as the book versions. And I think for that very reason, as you said.
Do you think that the books we choose to read define us as people?
I think a little bit. But I think when I was younger, I would almost read everything because I was just so curious. And even things I almost didn't quite know my tastes. So I would say probably at that time, they didn't necessarily define me because I was just a super curious reader. But I do think now I notice the books that I pick up, and I pick up because I know maybe there are certain themes in there that I think I will connect with, and I'm quite fussy about what I read. And I think that's probably because I read a lot for my job anyway. So when I've got time to read something outside of work, I am quite picky. So I think probably a little bit because I know that I'm looking in books for things that I want to read about. So I think they do define us in a little way, but it sort of depends on what kind of reader you are.
Yes, it's very true. And I guess what your job is as well, like you might not have the time. Yeah, I can speak for myself as well. I as much as I love to read, I don't always have the headspace like you. And when I do read, sometimes, you know, I'll pick up a book and feel quite disappointed that I can't get into it so much. Yeah. And then my perfectionism kind of kicks in and I'm like, I need to finish this book. I've started it. So I've started actually abandoning books now, which is not like me, but it's just, it's a time factor. It's just such a big thing, right, in life at the moment.
Yeah, I think that is something you have to do sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. You have to be picky about your time and how you spend it. So for this section, my last question for you is, are you reading anything at the moment and what are you reading?
Yes, so I might mention a book that I just finished reading because I still am thinking about it. I finished it last week, but I haven't picked up another book since. It's called Still Life by Sarah Winman and it's amazing. It was one of those books, I started reading it and within a few pages I knew that it was just going to consume my life for a bit. And it really did. It's like beautiful writing. It's the characters like jump off the page. It's one of those books where you just want to spend time with these characters. I actually read it out loud to my partner. We were excited for the next day so we could read more of it, almost like it was a box set or something like that. And I think that is a beauty of amazing storytelling. Sarah Winman absolutely knows how to write, knows how to capture whole worlds and scenes. And yeah, it's set in Florence as well as the East End of London, but it has a whole cast of characters and every single one of them is fully formed and you just feel like you know them. I would really recommend it.
I'll definitely check it out. And are you a Kindle or physical book person?
I'm definitely a physical book person. I love reading physical books, like the feel of pages. I think there's nothing better for me, but I do read a lot on Kindle for my job. So I make sure I read for my job on my Kindle and then I read books outside of work in print form.
Yeah, I'm similar. I mean, I don't work in publishing, but I try to kind of split my time between reading physical books and Kindle books. If there's something someone's really recommended and it's a quick read, I'll quickly download it.
Yeah.
But I'm now facing this issue where I cannot fit all my books on my bookshelf. And so I've got a pile behind me there that's just like growing. And I have this problem where I'm just like, this is not good for global warming. I just keep buying books. Can't stop. Okay, so we can move on to actually speaking about the book itself. So we actually haven't introduced it. I've got a copy over here. It's called The Reading List. And I would like you to, in your own words, just explain to us what this book is about and what it means to you in your personal life.
Yes. So The Reading List, it's a book for book lovers, really. It's a celebration of libraries. It's a book about grief and community and kind of finding family in unexpected places. It follows Mukesh, who is a lonely widower who lost his wife Naina 2 years before. and she was a huge book reader. And now he's trying to connect with his bookworm granddaughter Priya as well. But he's not a reader, so he's really finding that a struggle, and he's feeling lonely and kind of, he feels like other people have moved on with their lives and he hasn't quite. So one day he heads to the library where he meets Alicia. Alicia is a young library worker. She's working in the library over her summer holidays, kind of in, because her brother recommended that she should. He's the book lover in her family and she doesn't really read for fun. So when she meets Mukesh and he asks for book recommendations, she doesn't really have anything to suggest to him until she finds a reading list kind of hidden between the pages of To Kill a Mockingbird, and she thinks that that's a place to start. So she starts reading the books and recommending them to Mukesh, and they kind of come together and form this unlikely book group of two people, and a friendship too, at a time when they both need it the most. Because Alicia's going through some really difficult things at home. She's kind of caring for her mother with her brother as well. So she feels like her life is not quite the life that all her friends are living. So yeah, this friendship and this library kind of creates a really safe space for both of them, to kind of, and the books themselves sort of help them find joy as well.
That's so beautifully put. And I feel like you've given away just enough, not too much, because there is actually so much to it. And what I loved about it was, you know, how all the characters came together. I think that's also why I asked you whether you kind of just let it flow or whether you actually planned it, because it seems like you could not have written this without planning out all of the characters. And I love that you portray reading as being something so fundamental that can bring people together, because I think that's something that in real life we don't really always acknowledge unless, you know, we join a book club. But yeah, the average person that maybe doesn't read avidly wouldn't think of it as something that could actually bond two people who are so different in age and just in other circumstances may not have bonded in the same way.
Absolutely, yeah. I think, I always think, for me, because I used to hide behind books.
Same.
So my dada used to art, yeah. I think lots of us bookworms used to hide behind books, and it was like a great way to just not have to engage in the real world. But then I think, I remember I used to visit my dada in Wembley, and he would always ask me what book I was reading, because I would just like sit and be really quiet in a corner and not really engage at all. But he would ask me what I was reading, and it was an opportunity for me to open up. And I would kind of hide behind this book, but then eventually I would come out and I would talk to him, and it was a way to sort of start conversations. And I think that's when I realized books were about connecting with other people. I was so shy. I wouldn't just go and talk to someone, but if I could talk to someone about books for ages, and then once I started talking about books, it was impossible to get me to shut up. So I think for me, books have been something to escape into and kind of be in my own little world. But they've also been a way for me to actually come out of my shell too. I sort of wanted to use that with these two characters who in lots of ways are in their own shells, but the books bring them together. And as you say, yeah, they're very different in lots of ways, but because of these books and sharing something like that, they find that there are more things that they share. I love it. It ties into what you said as well about books, the books we choose defining us, and do they define us? Because I think this list obviously is kind of curated by someone, and they're books in some way that have defined maybe this character. And I think I find that when I go to a bookshop or go to a library and someone recommends me a book, it's not just telling you about a book they loved, it's also telling you about something about them too. And it's a lovely way to sort of, yeah, learn about people in slightly different ways.
I couldn't agree more. Like, you can learn so much about a person through what they're interested in reading. So obviously, this book is fiction. Do you read a lot of nonfiction? Have you ever considered writing a nonfiction?
I don't think I could write a nonfiction. I just don't think I would be. I think my brain doesn't quite work in that way. I think almost all the messages I'm able to convey definitely have to come through like fiction and characters and story. I love reading nonfiction, but I really love like narrative memoirs and things like that. And I really like listening to nonfiction on audiobooks as well. I think that's a really good way for me to consume nonfiction. But yeah, I don't think I could write one. I just don't think I'm smart enough.
Oh, don't put yourself down. But you have mentioned that your full-time, well, your day job is also within fiction publishing. So I think it doesn't, yeah. It's a nice transition into what you've created and hopefully what you'll continue to create more of. So I agree. And whenever I speak to people who like reading books, a lot of them have problems with nonfiction, specifically self-help, which is something that we could speak about about this for ages, but I have a very love-hate relationship with self-help because I mean half the time you read it and you feel motivated for like I don't know the duration of however long you've been reading it and then the next minute you forget about it. Alternatively, it's just pure BS and you're just like, okay, I'm wasting my time. But you know, there are people who really, really don't like the idea of self-help. Where do you stand with that kind of literature?
Yeah, so I don't read a lot of self-help, I guess, but I do sometimes dip into things and I will take useful pieces of advice from anywhere that I find it. And actually, in terms of like writing the reading list, I think there was a book, I can't remember what it was called now, which is awful, but it was a non-fiction kind of self-helpy book, and it was about kind of waking up early and looking out the window for a little bit before you start your day. And that is basically what I did before I started my writing. Every morning when I woke up early, I would look out the window for like 15 minutes with like a cup of coffee and just like watch the world and like that really quiet moment before everyone's awake. And that was just so peaceful, and it just helped me kind of I'm not a morning person at all, but like doing that helped me become probably a morning person. It helped focus me. But also I think I used that time productively in some ways to think about what I was going to write in that next hour. So it was quite a creative thing, but it also kind of gave me some space from like waking up and that feeling of like, oh, I've got to get up and do some work now, to it was a moment where I could kind of switch my brain on and start to feel inspired. And it felt like it was just me and the world for a little bit. So that is a piece of advice I've taken from a book that I wish I could remember the name of it. But yeah, so I take pieces of advice from any books I read, whether it's like self-help or like fiction or nonfiction, or like blog posts and things like that. So yeah, I do definitely absorb like those little bits of advice, and if they work for me, I stick to them.
I love that. I think it's the last bit that you said, which was whatever works for me, I stick to. Because if you get into a rut of consuming a lot of that, it's not humanly possible for you to implement everything. You know, people talk about journaling as a great thing, yeah, and waking up and looking out the window, like you mentioned, you know, having a nice cup of tea or lemon water or doing yoga in the morning. But you could kind of consume all of that in one go and try and implement it all at once, and everything comes crashing down, and the next day you're back to your old habits. So I totally agree. It's that, I guess it's just finding what works for you, and books are just maybe one means of learning about those techniques.
Absolutely.
So going back to the reading list, I noticed that one big theme that cropped up across a lot of the characters was loneliness. And I wanted to understand, I guess, what motivated you to make that such a big part of this book and kind of portray that message that reading can really curb loneliness and feelings of loneliness. Because I saw that in almost all of the characters. So it really struck me.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think in lots of ways, it was almost subconscious, this idea of loneliness. And I knew that I wanted community to play a big part. And I think quite often community feels in some ways like the antidote to loneliness, though it isn't always. I think loneliness has always been something in my life, not necessarily actively, but I'm an only child. So I remember like often not feeling lonely because I was often in my own little world too, but that feeling of just sometimes it was just me just doing my thing and not feeling and feeling like other people were getting on with their lives outside. And I do remember like hearing some people like playing like on the street and stuff, and if I wasn't playing with them, it was just that feeling that there was a world going on outside and I wasn't quite there. And then when I moved to London for the first time, I think that was like a particularly lonely period of my life, because I was living with one of my good friends who had like a super busy job, and I was often in the flat on my own, and I was quite nervous to explore places and kind of wasn't quite sure how to make friends. Lots of my friends are like still living at home, so there weren't loads of people in my life that I could just spend my time with. And I think then there's also the other aspect of kind of feeling lonely when other people are around you, like when you're in a really busy house or something. Even that can feel lonely if you're not necessarily making those important connections, having those conversations that feel like they mean something. And I think I have had times when sometimes hanging out with friends and I felt like I've not been connecting with them in the way that I should be. I can feel that there's a little bit of a distance, and it's probably most of the time coming from me, but I've not known how to bridge that gap and stop myself feeling lonely. So you sort of like, again, like the world is going on around you, and even though you're surrounded by people, it can feel quiet. So yeah, I think that's kind of bled into all the characters in some way. And this idea that, like, for example, Mukesh, he's got his family around him, he's got his daughters who really care for him, but at the same time they're caring for him, but they're not necessarily connecting with him or asking him like how he is, or having those conversations that make him really feel heard. And then yeah, similarly, Alicia has got a really busy life, but then her friends are living a different life to her and she doesn't feel like she can quite connect with them. So I think we've all felt loneliness even if we're surrounded by people, and I think London in particular can be a really lonely city.
I felt like I was talking to myself, like I was hearing myself, because I'm also an only child, and so much of my life has been about not feeling like there's enough commotion around me, it's too quiet. And I think maybe it might be this case for you, but for me certainly I hid behind books because they were my sanctuary. I could you know, pretend I wasn't lonely for a little bit because I had all these characters around me. And on the flip side though, I feel like talking to friends who, you know, from the outside look like they are surrounded by people that love them and they have fun things going on, you know, they have big Christmas celebrations and big Diwali celebrations and everything is just seems like it's buzzing, you could talk to them and still hear that, you know, but I feel lonely all the time, or, you know, I just wish I had a bit more of my own space, but so that I could get over that feeling of loneliness, if that even makes sense. Yeah. Because like you said, you can feel even more lonely when you are surrounded by people, because there's too much almost white noise around you and you're just like, there's not enough connection. And you know, speaking of feeling like you're the one that's almost a bit detached, I have felt that recently with, you know, lockdown restrictions opening and everything. I ripped off the band-aid and I met friends and everything, but I don't know about you, but I definitely have times where I'm hanging out with friends and I just feel completely just almost like in my head, I'm in my own world. Like I'm not able to connect because maybe I've just depleted my ability to connect that particular day. Have you felt that way recently?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm kind of so glad you said that, because I think so many people, I think that's definitely a thing about socializing at the moment. And I find that I almost notice when I'm switching off, and I'm not meaning to switch off, but I can just feel it when I'm just almost disconnected from the conversation or don't quite know the best thing to do and feel like I'm almost overthinking everything to the point that I can't quite connect or socialize in the way that I maybe used to. So yeah, I think lockdown has definitely had an impact on that.
Yeah, and it's also having been so connected digitally to everyone, because we've not had a choice, that I think it's probably only going to get worse from a loneliness standpoint. Aren't there statistics suggesting that, you know, the coming generation are lonelier than ever and things like that, because we're all so connected digitally but disconnected just mentally? So that's, I think that makes this story so relevant, because seeing characters of different ages, you know, from someone who's a bit more elderly to someone who's late teens, and they're kind of, they've all got this shared experience even though their environments are completely different, is very interesting, seeing that it never really goes away and we kind of live with it day to day. How did you come up with the reading list specifically? So could you give us a bit of background around what this list is, and also just what kind of spurred you on to pick the books that you did for the list?
Yes. So the list is, so Alicia finds a reading list tucked within the pages of a book, and it's sort of, in a way, is her first introduction into reading books for fun, I guess, and beyond school. And the books are, I don't think this gives anything away really, it's To Kill a Mockingbird, Rebecca, Little Women, Life of Pi, The Kite Runner, oh, I'm going to forget one, Pride and Prejudice, Beloved, and A Suitable Boy. And yeah, it was really hard picking the books, but actually they almost, when I thought about the books I wanted to include, in a way, they just came to me straight away. And I think it's because they're books that I read at a time. I remember actually some of them were recommended to me on a reading list of their own from one of my English teachers, when I was really struggling in lots of ways to, I guess, read books for fun again. I wasn't feeling necessarily inspired by the books that I was reading for school. One of my English teachers recommended me all these amazing books. They're not all on that list, but it was my chance to kind of read things I hadn't read before for fun. And yeah, so To Kill a Mockingbird was on that list, definitely. And I just remember the experience of that book for the first time. And it's one where I remembered exactly where I was when I was reading it, to the point where now when I look back, I can't remember if that was a scene in the book or if it was where I was reading it. But they just had such tangible memories for me attached to them. And I think Life of Pi, for example, I absolutely adored because it was just a whole new world. And they're all books I read when I was quite young, so like a teenager, at that stage where you're sort of, when I was falling in love with reading, falling in love with finding new books and new stories. And in particular, The Kite Runner was one I did do for school, but I read it so many times. And I remember, I think it was a point at which I was reading characters of colour in stories for the very first time. A Suitable Boy, similarly, I just adored that book. And yeah, it felt like those were some of the books anyway that expanded my reading and had a really big impact on me as a reader. And I just, yeah, I was intrigued to see what my characters would be like experiencing them, those books, for the first time.
That's amazing that you kind of described your characters as just almost from a curious standpoint of letting them live their own life, even though you wrote the entire book. I've read some of the books in that list, and actually it's really interesting how relevant so many of those are even today, in today's day and age, with To Kill a Mockingbird, with all the anti-racism conversations that are being had at the moment. I found it really interesting when you mentioned in the book at one point with A Suitable Boy, there was a comment made about how it was used as a doorstopper. I cracked up because I have a copy of A Suitable Boy and I never realized how big that book is. And when it arrived, I think my jaw dropped and I just haven't picked it up because I'm just like, I've watched it, so I know what's happening in it. I think, was it the BBC show or...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so it came out as a series, didn't it? And it's, again, one of those ones I regret watching before I read it. But because I know what's going to happen, I'm just like, do I really want to read?
Please read the book. Please read the book.
I'll start it.
It's just like...
I'm just really, so really like, I'm daunted by it because I keep looking at it and it's just there. I have the same thing with Shantaram as well, which I've read half of and then it just kind of fizzled out. So, yeah. It might end up as a doorstopper, but I will read it.
I know. Yeah, I would never use a book as a doorstopper, just because my mum, if she heard that, she'd be horrified because she's so like, would can't mine. Treat books like that.
You don't put books on the floor.
Exactly. I would never do that. But this character, I mean, when you get, if anyone reads the book and gets to that point, will kind of understand why this character is the one who does that and no one else does. But I remember seeing A Super Boy in like all my friends' parents' houses, like on the bookshelves when I was like really young. So like the spine is almost like ingrained on my memory because I've seen the spine more than anything else. And then, yeah, I remember I went to like a secondhand bookshop and found it and I was like, maybe I'll read this. And I did. And I read it in a week really quickly. And I was in my school summer holiday, so I had loads of time. And it's just so clever and so expansive. And I've read Shantaram as well. But like for me, A Suitable Boy, I could not put it down. And I know some people who've like spent a long time reading it, and I think I also wish I'd like savored it over several months too. But it's 100%. I haven't watched the whole of the series yet. And I think I kind of want to reread the book again. So I want that to be the thing that's at the forefront of my mind rather than the series. But yeah, there's so much in it and so many interesting themes and characters, and there's just so much life in it. I think I learned a lot from that book, to the point where, so I'm not giving too much away, but the characters don't quite read all of it. And I think it's because I could have written a whole new book if the characters are reading A Suitable Boy, because there's so much in it. But yeah, it is a big, chunky, daunting book, but it's worth it, definitely.
From a logistical standpoint, what was the process like for you from conception of the idea to having it in your hands?
I think it's kind of been, in some ways, a very long process, or at least it's felt like that. But actually, probably in the grand scheme of things, it's been quite quick. And I think that's because once I had that plan down for the book, I wrote it fairly quickly and then spent a long time editing it. So I wrote it in about a full draft in about 3 months. And then it was a rough draft and it was really bad. And now I think about that now and I was thinking, oh, it was a bit of a mess, but it did have a structure to it. And then, yeah, I signed with my agent when I had about 20,000 words, which is a little unconventional, but she was just amazing. She just really loved the 20,000 words and kind of really believed in the book. And I think me having someone else believe in it really helped me believe in it too. So yeah, that kind of really spurred me on to write it. And yes, yeah, so I finished it in kind of summer of 2019. We did a few rounds of edits on it when it was kind of changing shape, kind of developing the characters, developing the themes. One thing I've realized is quite often I write everything quite subtly and no one else gets it but me, because I'm like, oh, obviously it's there, but actually it's not really there. And other readers can't see it. So then I was lucky enough to get the book deal in 2019, and I remember at the end of 2019, and I remember getting, because I was working in publishing at the time too, so I was almost living both sides of it, and I was seeing all the buzz around all the books, and I was just thinking, oh gosh, there's so many amazing books out there, is anyone going to care about mine? But I was really lucky to find an amazing editor who just, when I met her, she had such an amazing vision for the book, but it challenged me to think in more creative ways, and that's exactly what I needed from an editor. And she wanted to like really shake up things with the book and kind of really push me to do the best I could for that book, and I knew that that's what I needed, and her vision aligned with mine, and everything that she wanted out of the book was exactly what I wanted too. So we spent about probably just over a year, maybe just under a year actually, editing that book, and there were kind of three fairly big edits, and each time like big structural things changed, new things were added, and I feel like I was sort of tweaking it right until the point when it was like, right, taking it away from you, it's going out to people. But those processes of those edits, which were quite in depth, were so vital in terms of clarifying my thought processes behind the book, kind of clarifying what I wanted it to say to people. It took longer to edit it than it did to write it. And I think that's probably because I wrote it so quickly and there were loads of things that weren't necessarily on the page. It made me really grateful to be an editor too, because I suddenly realised how valuable it is to have someone else's like view on your book to really help you push this story along and be the best it can be.
Yeah. Are you someone who's quite kind of all or nothing? Like, do you kind of really get into it and just get it all done in a short space of time? Is that how you normally work?
I think so. I think because I don't have a lot of time to like ruminate on things or like dedicate to things necessarily. So when I knew with this book, I had to get it done quickly. Otherwise my mind would keep skipping out of the book. I would lose focus, and I would lose, I guess, the train of the voice. Quite a lot of times I'd had books where I'd write in a spurt and then I'd leave it for 3 months. I'd come back to it and not know the story at all and kind of have to start from scratch. So writing quite quickly works for me because it means my head is always in that story, and it means there's consistency. It means that I'm focused. It means that my brain is working creatively even when I'm not typing, because I know that I'm going to be typing soon. So like with my second book, I haven't written it. I basically took kind of a couple of weeks off work and wrote it in that time, kind of over the like Christmas break, really quickly, just like every day trying to write something so my head stayed in the game, basically. And that definitely works for me now, because I think I find it really hard otherwise to sort of stop something and then come back to it a bit later and pick up where I left off. Sort of feels to me like I have to really boost my energy again for it, and I don't have the energy for it.
Does anyone have any energy these days?
I know.
So it sounds to me like you kind of got in the momentum of things and you just basically banged it out in 3 months, and and if you'd taken a break, maybe self-doubt would have crept in, maybe you would have 100%. Kind of looked around too much at what other people are doing as well. I finally had something very similar with this podcast. I kind of lost the momentum, and it's very easy to kind of go into either a positive spiral of productivity or a negative spiral of wallowing.
Absolutely.
So I think a lot of us do go through that, and it's just like probably the most relatable thing right now for anyone trying to pursue anything creative as well that requires them to self-motivate.
So I
find it really impressive that you did that and you motivated yourself to write every day, especially during Christmas holidays where everyone just wants to be in a food coma all day.
I know. It was quite good though, because I wrote the second book basically in lockdown, and because like I wasn't seeing my family over the Christmas break or anything, I was like, oh, I might as well do this. I would procrastinate pretty much half the day, and then I would just like spend an hour writing, and I knew that I just had to be productive, and having that time pressure as well, I think, is useful, and knowing that I just needed to do it.
Definitely. I'm actually curious, when you're writing, do you think about, okay, you know, this is what's going to happen in this chapter, so I kind of need to write around all of that? Or were you still kind of letting your brain just flow with it? So I guess what I'm asking is, did you have a skeleton for the book before you started writing it, or did you build up as you went on?
I guess a little bit of both, because I kind of had an overarching idea of what the main points were. It was sort of like a 5-page synopsis, so a little bit narrative, but I used those like 5 to 15 minutes staring out of the window to work out what actually I was going to write that day. And quite often it was like a chapter at a time, so I was sort of like, I knew that this plot point was coming up, or like this thing that the character needed to do, and then I'll sort of think about the creative detail of it in those 15 minutes, and sometimes it surprised me and sometimes it was just like, yeah, this is obviously what needs to happen, and I'd write it. Quite a lot of that got pulled out, but it was really useful to have to write everything down, and I loved those moments where I was like looking out the window and new ideas came to me. And because my head was so much in the book, sometimes I'd be like walking around, I'd hear a conversation, a snippet of conversation, and that would inspire a whole new scene in the book, and I'd be excited to write it the next day. So I think I found that really useful with the first book, the reading list. But then with the second book, because we're sort of in lockdown a little bit more, I actually found like thinking of what to write that day so much harder. And it was almost, I think because of that, a little bit slower in terms of putting words on the page, but at the same time I think I was a little bit more detailed too, because it was almost not necessarily the quantity of the ideas, but it was like drawing them out and really fleshing them out. So in lots of ways, the first draft of my second novel feels a bit more fully fleshed out. So it's been really interesting kind of writing in lockdown and also writing before lockdown and seeing how my brain works with those two creative situations, I guess.
Yeah. It sounds also like you grew a lot from that experience. And do you think a lot of what you experienced while writing the reading list got you to that point of being able to be faster at writing what you wanted to?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think I found the second book way harder to write the first draft. And I think I had way more self-doubt with the second book than I did with the first. And I think it's just this consciousness of knowing that the first book's going to be out, and actually there are going to be readers who read it, and some people will like it and some people will hate it, and just knowing that it's been harder to switch off from the fact that people will read it when I've been writing the second book, because I've got a 2-book deal, so I know it will be published, I know it's going to be out there. So I think I found that side of it harder. But definitely, like, all the conversations I've had with my editor and my agent have really helped me grow as a writer, and I've learned so much from that experience. Like, I think also just, I guess, my relationship with them and knowing more of what they look for, what they like, and what works for me, and how we work really well together has fed into this book. For example, like, I remember the reading list used to be really, like, it didn't have much dialogue at all. That was a main point. Everyone's like, there needs to be more dialogue in this, and like, you're quite good at dialogue, why isn't there more? And I think that's because I was so much like caught up in all the detail. I was like, I need everyone to know absolutely how this appears in my head. Whereas the second one is way more dialogue heavy already, because I just almost know that that's what brings things to life and brings scenes and characters and situations to life more in many ways than the internal thought processes of each of the characters. So yeah, there are some really practical things that I think I've taken from the experience of editing in particular book one into book two.
Of getting a book deal, tell me about that. Like, it's HarperCollins, it's incredible that you've got a book deal with them. And what was the process like for that?
So once I kind of had signed with my agent and she was ready to like send it out to publishers, sort of had a list of publishers that we were going to send it to. And this was, it's so interesting because even though I'm an editor and I'm often one of the people on those lists who receive submissions, I had never seen this other side of it. And it was just amazing to have my agent's insight on who might be a good fit for my book, who might really like it, who was looking for this sort of story. Then kind of the book was out on submission. I think it was like 2 weeks, and then we got the first offer on the book. And then we kind of started getting more interest as well. So I think I had a total of 3 offers, first of all, and that was amazing because I was like, there are 3 editors out there who like my book enough to like pay me some money to write it and to publish it. Then I met with those editors and they kind of pitched me their visions, and I was basically blown away by all of them. And they all had really clear visions for my book, and all amazing visions that I think they all would have worked. But yeah, it was interesting because I think I just really clicked with my editor at HarperCollins, and really I felt invested in her vision for the book, and I felt really excited by it. Then we kind of went with HarperCollins, and the rest was history, as people say. But it was an amazing process, and I think their vision for it, just thinking really creatively about it. And I think one of the main things for me was the editorial notes that my editor Charlotte had just really chimed with me. It was everything I wanted to do for the book. And yeah, I loved that. And I loved that it was going to be a challenge because it spoke to the heart of the story and what I wanted the story to say all along. But I just knew that the draft as it was wasn't doing the job, and Charlotte knew how to get it there. She's been really patient working with me and has been so creative. So I've loved that process. Yeah, it was amazing. I remember my parents were so over the moon. My mum, I think, has forgotten about me being a lawyer now that I'm going to have books on shelves. So yeah, that's really exciting.
I see another parallel with one of the characters in there. So it sounds like a lot of it is coming from your personal life as well and your own story.
Yeah, definitely.
For example, when you're pitching to potential editors, I know I'm like kind of probing a little bit, but I want to know, do you present to them? Like, is it like a PowerPoint deck, or do you just send them kind of a synopsis of the book? How does that work?
So pitching to agents is like the thing that basically authors have to do themselves. So you kind of have to, different agencies have different submission guidelines. So some of them ask for like the first 3 chapters or the first 50 pages of your novel, plus a synopsis and a cover letter. So that kind of gives them a little bit of information about you and your ambitions for the book, as well as like an overall plot of where it might go. But I think the thing that they pay most attention to is basically the writing itself. And yeah, so those first 3 chapters should be like really polished and kind of as good as a writer wants them to be. And then if they love it, they will ask for the full manuscript. And I mean, lots of agents do work in slightly different ways, and it can be a case by case basis. But generally, it's always good to go through their guidelines and follow exactly what they need to see. So yeah, I think lots of writers I know like send to quite a lot of agents. Some send to kind of a few at a time, depending on how they want to organise it. But yeah, it only ever takes one agent to love your book. So I think, and there are so many agents out there, I think that's the important thing. But yeah, then an agent will work with an author on kind of shaping the novel, and kind of the agent will help the author, I guess, visualise their career and make sure that they're writing exactly what they want to be writing and doing what they want to be doing. And then the agents have connections with editors and publishers and kind of are often in touch with with editors even, to know what they're looking for, kind of what the trends in the market are. And yeah, when the book is ready to submit, they'll submit to a selection of editors, at which stage kind of the onus is taken off the author to be doing any pitching. The book should speak for itself, and the agent sort of pitches to the editor. And then, yeah, I guess when it comes to the point of offers, quite often it can then, there might be an author agent meeting, but not always. But I think that's a point at which the editor sort of has to pitch their vision to the author and agent and show why they're a really good fit for this book, what they'll do with the book. And yeah, I think that's quite a nice position to be in at that stage, because you get to see if someone is going to publish your book in the way that you imagined, or in like even more exciting ways. And I think that it's interesting, kind of, I have the background knowledge of what editor pitch meetings are like, because I've been the one pitching to authors before. So I love being on the other side of it and just kind of seeing how it works and what it feels like to be an author in that moment, and how exciting it is and terrifying, but so inspiring to know that someone else has read your book and believes in your book. But I think the one thing to note is sometimes authors will work with an agent and their first book might not sell, but it's all really useful. I think any feedback you get from anyone will always help, I guess, help you progress as a writer. So the first book, lots of people, the first book they write isn't the book that gets published. And for me, this wasn't the first book I wrote, though it is the first one that's getting published and the first one that got an agent. So just keep going. I think that's the main thing. Like, you never know when the book that will be the one is going to find you, but it will.
I just thought of pancakes. You know, you make the first one and it's always bad, but then the next ones are great. So you just got to keep going, I guess.
Exactly. That's such a good analogy. I love that.
I'm just constantly thinking about food. What was the hardest thing throughout this process of launching this book, The Reading List? And I'm thinking from like a mental perspective, some setback that you might have had to overcome during this process.
Yeah, because lots of this process for me has been in lockdown. I have found that I've sat with my anxieties and my worries way more than maybe I usually would. Like, maybe before I would have like called up a friend or like spoken to a colleague in the office about something that I was worried about and for a bit of reassurance. And I just haven't done that as much. I know that I've let my anxieties about everything build up and up and up to the point where sometimes it's got like overwhelming, and I felt more overwhelmed in this year than I ever have, because so much has gone on, like in my personal life but also with the book, and it's been such an exciting year and I've been like, my dream is coming true. But that at the same time, that doesn't always necessarily mean that you're happy with everything. And I think I have felt like I have let myself doubt creep in quite a lot. I've often felt like, is this book good enough? Is it good enough to be published? I know that some people believe in it, but will readers like it? And is it saying what I want it to say? And I think one thing that I felt particularly conscious of is just worrying that my messages will get misconstrued, or kind of like people will read things into the book that aren't there, or things that I never intended. I think that's just always been my worry. Whenever you put something out into the world, in a way it stops being yours and it becomes the reader's. And I think that is, yeah, that's just a chance you have to take when you're doing this. And it's just been a process, I guess, to coming to accept that. But now that it's out there, I'm feeling more distant from the book in a good way. I'm feeling like I'm really proud of it. It's got so much of my heart in there. And yeah, I just hope that readers like it or take something, like take some hope from it, I guess. But at the same time, I know that it's out of my control, and that's something I just need to learn to live with.
There will definitely be people who resonate with a lot of the themes in the book. I can tell you that already, because I already have. Oh, so you've got one person. But yeah, I could not agree more, because when you create something and put it out there, it's kind of there, like floating around in for eternity. You can't really do much after that. And you can only hope that people will take the best out of it, forgive you if, you know, you offended them in any way, but also hope that it will only age well over time. You know, that's another worry. But I've also started adopting this mentality of, it's no longer mine. Once it's out, I don't dwell on it. I focus on other things. And do you think that maybe writing the second book now is actually helping you detach from the anxieties of the first book, because now you're all your energy is on the second one?
I think so, yeah. It was interesting you mentioned that. I talk about the characters as though they're like real people, because to me now they are living lives of their own, and they're like beyond me and they're doing their thing, and like my attention is now on book two and kind of making sure that those characters are kind of saying what I need them to say or what they should be saying. So it's definitely helpful having another project to work on. I think for a little while it felt a bit overwhelming having two things going on at once, but now, yeah, it's really nice. I've kind of got a new story to think about and new messages to get across. And while there are some similar themes, lots of it is brand new. So yeah, it's really fun to be thinking creatively about something else when I've lived with the other book for so long.
Yeah. Well, I feel like amazing things are coming up and they're already happening. So I'm really, really happy for you and excited for you.
Thank you so much.
I had a couple more questions and then I promise we'll wrap up. One of my questions is around finances. Now, I know that you've mentioned that you have, you know, maybe a 9-to-5, or you'd have a day job and then you kind of wrote this book on the side. How feasible do you think it is to write a book if you don't have, say, like a steady income?
But yeah, that's a really, really good question. I remember I remember having this dream about getting like £1 million book deal or something, and then I would just live on that and quit my job and just write. Even though I realized actually I don't think just writing is what I want to do anyway. I do love my job. So yeah, I think it's completely dependent on author to author, because I think advances and publishing contracts differ so greatly. And it's a business, so some things, yeah, some authors do get £1 million book deals and stuff straight away, and some don't, and some kind of build and grow. So it really does depend. For me, I am aware that I kind of have a 2-book deal, which means I'm kind of get money contracted for those 2 books, but then I don't know what's going to happen after those 2 books, whether anyone's going to want to buy more books from me and whether it's going to be sustainable. So yeah, I think for me, I knew that it's probably my mum in my head as well, like, you need stability and like stick with a job that has a salary. So yeah, so I've kind of have still been working. I work 4 days a week because my income from the book means that I can work on a pro rata salary. And I probably, yeah, I basically am really conscious of that. I just want to be able to sustain writing for as long as possible. So I want to be able to continue writing even after this book 2 contract is done, and maybe I'm out of contract and no one else wants any more books from me. I still want to be able to have the freedom to do that. But for me, I think that will always be working at least part-time, for a while anyway. Who knows? If I do get £1 million book deal ever, I might quit my job and just live in an amazing house and just write all the time. But also, I think the way that my brain works, I would like to have a job and a salary, because I think part of me feels I need that stability and I would get anxious not having that. I really admire people who go freelance and kind of live freelance completely, because I just think that takes so much organising as well. And that's almost something that I don't quite have. My mum wishes I did, but I haven't got there yet.
I feel like you found what works for you, and that's the best thing you can really do at any given point in time, right? Because we all fantasize about that life of, you know, living in a house and doing my creative projects and just having loads of money sitting there. But the reality is so different, but not just from a financial standpoint, but also from a mental, from a productivity standpoint. Sitting in a house working on a creative project all day might not be the best way that we all work. Maybe I know for me, I've learned that doing different things and, you know, dabbling in different things at the same time, not literally at the same time, but in a week, I would do different things. It keeps me motivated. And, you know, if I was on an island writing a book, I would probably just be not doing much.
And I know, because for a little while I worked 3 days a week. So I had 2 days to work on my book. And I found I did not do quite as much work in those 2 days. In fact, I don't think I did any work in those 2 days because I just felt like I had way too much time. So having, 1 day a week is great for me at the moment. And who knows what will happen in the future and whether I will find that I need more time. But at the moment, I do like the time pressure and having to do lots of things in 1 week. And as you say, like doing different things too. It helps keep me focused and keep me motivated.
Yeah, and inspired as well, right? Because you never know what you could learn from one thing and apply to the next.
Absolutely.
So I can see this book becoming a film or like a Netflix series or something. Do you have any hopes and dreams for it to eventually become a franchise or something more?
Oh, I would love for it to be a film or something. Like my dad, who hasn't even read it yet because he's waiting to buy it and then read it. He wants to go into a bookshop and buy it. He has said, I would love this book to be a film. And he was like, I think it would make a brilliant film. My mum would also want it to be a film too. But I would just love to see Mukesh and Alicia like on TV. And I think that would be lovely. But also I know that it doesn't happen a lot. But that would be a big dream of mine. I just think it's quite visual in my head. I would just love to see it. And also it's set in Wembley, somewhere that I really love and somewhere that we don't see on TV a lot beyond like the football and like the Beyonce concerts and stuff like that. I want to see like the real Wembley on TV depicted with real people and real characters who we know. So yeah, I would love that.
For me, it was when you described the temple in the book. I can visualize myself walking in because I've been there before. And so, yeah, it's definitely been written in a way where it could easily be, you know, it could definitely be something very visual. Because I thought the same as you when I read it. I was like, this could definitely be a film.
So, oh, thank you. I'm so pleased.
Fingers crossed.
I hope any film producers listening might think about it too.
Okay, so do you have any piece of advice for any aspiring author who's never written a book before, doesn't know where to start, maybe thinks, oh, I'm not good enough? What would you say to them and how would you get them to kickstart their journey?
I would say kind of keep going and keep writing and do your best to turn off that inner critic while you're writing, because I think that can really impede you doing anything. And I think you need words on the page, and they don't have to be amazing words straight away, because you can work on them and you can tweak them and edit them, and that's a whole process in itself. But I think keep going, and if you feel that something you're writing isn't working, don't be afraid to try something completely different and step away from that book that maybe you thought was amazing, because you never know, the next idea you come to might be the one.
Love that piece of advice. Thank you for sharing that and for sharing so much with us today. And I'm so glad that I was able to pick your brain. So thank you for your time. Final question that I ask everybody is, Sara, what do you have strong game in?
I think I have strong game in keeping going even when that self-doubt creeps in. And I think it's very much a case of like having to not listen to that self-doubt for a bit, but I know now that I don't quit. For a little while I did think I might quit writing and wouldn't do it, but yeah, I think having that book out next week tells me that I can keep going.
Yeah, it'll be a physical reminder for you forever if you ever experience self-doubt again. I love that. It's been a lovely time chatting to you, and I wish you all of the success with this book. I mean, I have no doubt that people are going to love it, and I'm already excited for your second one. So,
oh, thank you so much, Mithali. It was so lovely to chat to you, and I feel like we could have spoken forever. Because sounds like we got so much in common. But thank you so much. It's been so lovely to chat to you.